Welcome to Combox. Jared Kimber here for the show that answers your questions on cricket. Wagon Wheel. The best way to ask them is if you're watching live at the moment, you can go on YouTube and you can ask a super chat over there. But as always, probably the easiest way is if you are actually asking them beforehand on Patreon, like Reese has. So you can go to the Good Areas podcast on Patreon and you can support us there and ask a couple of questions a week if you want for the Wagon Wheel podcast. So that is what we are doing right now. And Reese says, is the county championship becoming more and more like a Premier League model in terms of the teams that win it? Surrey dominating recently. Some of the golfing class between squads seems ridiculous. I think once you had the, you know, League One and League Two, there was always going to be that model. There's a really good article up on Substack recently about how hard it is for the poorer teams to actually spend money on talent anymore. And I think that the case I remember is Sussex, who are not one of the very poor teams, but certainly compared to Surrey, you know, there's a huge difference. Look, I do think over the longest period of time, money eventually just wins in every sporting franchise, right? Like even simple things, facilities and coaches and everything else. You know, you look at a team like the LA Clippers who've never been any good, but have one, you know, the richest owner. I kind of just feel one way or another, they're going to work it out and make it work the way that they should. Because I do think that over a long timeline, money eventually wins. But yeah, I remember covering Surrey. So I lived around the corner from the Oval and I, you know, did a little bit of county work occasionally. And I remember just being surprised that they couldn't work it out. And some of the people are the same, like Alex Stewart was involved then and is involved now. And it's over the period of time, it feels like they just keep making little changes that make sense. But also, you know, one of my friends is their coach, Gareth Buddy, and sometimes we'll talk about his squad. And I'll just be like, your B team could probably win second division, right? Like the amount of talent that they have on their books at any one time. And now, not only do you get to live in London, not only do you get to get paid quite well to play for Surrey, the third thing in all of that is also that Surrey has now produced so many England players that people who are doing well at other teams are coming to Surrey knowing that they're probably going to be seen more, right? So you compare that to Middlesex. Middlesex is a London team, right? But Middlesex has no money. They are so skint at all times. You know, I've talked to both of these both of these county teams at times about work. Obviously, I briefly worked for Surrey back in the day, and you know, I've talked to Middlesex about doing stuff. They're just like they're in different tiers, and so I think eventually that's what happens. Money wins. Mob says, can you please take us through Daz Mitchell versus Usman Tariq in the PSL? Mitchell pulled out during the delivery stride two balls in a row because Tariq's trademark pause was distracting. Quetta was livid. Ashwin is backing Mitchell and his tactic. Who is in the right here and what is the ideal objective? Or will this just be a battle of the dickheads? All things in cricket is a battle of the dickheads. When Usman Tariq first came in and people would send me clips of him going, look, this man's chucking. I'd be like, he's not chucking. He's bowling with a bent arm. I said, the issue here is there's another legal issue, which is he's bowling the hesitation delivery, which Xavier Doherty and Syed Ajmal were told not to bowl. And I didn't understand why. And I did talk, you know, chat to people a little bit. I think the thinking was that Usman Tariq did it every delivery and that his hesitation was quite similar, right? And so it wasn't as if he was bringing in this hesitation. So baseball had a hesitation pitch through the great Satchel Paige, who eventually gets to a point where they ban it because no one else can hit it and it's causing a bit of an issue and it's also ugly and a bit odd. And when it came into cricket, I wondered how long it would take for cricket to stop it, and it didn't take long, right? This is a little bit different because I think what Usman Tariq would say at this stage is the hesitation is built into his action. But you can also see what someone like Ashwin would say is, well, I'm not allowed to do that, so why is he allowed to do that? So I think they're both kind of, I think Usman Tariq is right and Ashwin is right at the moment as the way that Daryl Mitchell was completely in the right. So you've got two people on two different sides of the argument and I would say they're both in the right. Usman Tariq has not been called for this before. So to say that he's doing something wrong doesn't make sense. However, if he's going to keep doing this, cricket needs to make a decision and the MCC and the playing condition, ICC, will have to make a decision very soon if it's okay to have a natural pause in your bowling action or not. of this amount of time. And I think that's where it comes to it. The one I would say, there was one in the NBA a few years ago, I can't remember, but you needed to shoot a free throw within 10 or 15 seconds. There was some regulation, but it was never enforced, right? And then it came to the point that with Giannis Antetokounmpo, he would literally take so long that the opposition crowd would start to count down how long he had. And so the NBA actually had to start like taking that regulation seriously. And I think Usman Tariq's in that similar situation. They have to decide where they want to go. Do we want to have a game where the bowlers stop as part of a natural thing at the crease? I would say Usman Tariq's getting a big advantage from this at the moment, and other bowlers can't do it, or can't do it unless they do it consistently, which is also tough if you've never done it before. I don't mind if we allow him to do it and other bowlers do it. We just have to make a decision. And at the moment, I think we're stuck between the two. I'm not an expert if there's been some changes in the regulations recently, but the last time I looked into it, you weren't allowed to do what they described was an unnatural pause. I would say if Usman Tariq's doing it every ball, it's not actually an unnatural pause. So they might need to look at the wording. Anil says, lots of wides this IPL. I've already done a video on it, and I've got another video on it to come. Presumably because of the bowlers bowling wider lines to keep out of the arc. Is that a good trade-off here, to err on the side of bowling wide every 10 balls instead of a slot ball on middle? It does work. Look, it doesn't always work. There was an over recently, which we did a whole video on, which was Ashdeep, where I would have said that being how that game was going at the moment, at that time, the expected runs in that over were probably about 9 or 10. He ends up bowling a whole load of full tosses, of wide, sorry, and the over goes for 12. And I just don't think he needed to do it. But we saw Dewald Brevis, who was about to go nuts and take KKR out of the game the other day, go out to a wide Yorker. We've seen a lot of players, when they're hitting boundaries, lose their swing when suddenly they have to bat completely differently because the ball's so wide outside off stump. So it can work. It wouldn't be existing if it didn't work. There's lots of really fascinating parts of this, though. Bowls and LBWs are disappearing out of T20 cricket because of this. I said on a recent, I think it was on a watch along, that we might be in a position in the future where in the last two overs of T20 games, we might have to make it so that wides count as doubles. I just think it's actually ruining the game a little bit. I'm trying to think of another sport that probably had something. So it's a bit like when baseball had that issue a couple of years ago of the ball was never in play anymore, right? It was either a strike or a home run, and it took out a part of the game, and it was because of the shifts, and basically for the first time ever in that sport using fielders correctly, right? And so I do think at that point there was a bit of an issue with the way that went. And so they felt that it was less entertaining. So sometimes you would also have, I think in European basketball, you would have what they would call a take foul when it was going to be a slam dunk, off a turnover or off, a quick transition play. In Europe, they would actually foul people on purpose to stop that. And I think eventually, I don't know if all leagues change this, but in the NBA specifically, I think they looked at it and went, well, we want people to slam dunk, right? Like, it's smarter basketball to foul them. We get that, but we don't want that. Like, if you're ahead and you're running down to do a slam dunk, the last thing we want is someone grabbing you from behind on your shirt and we end up with free throws, right? And so I think we're getting to that point in T20 cricket where we need to make a decision. The end of games at the moment is dreadful to watch, right? The end of innings, I should say, can be absolutely dreadful, and we need to make a decision. Ellie says, why don't franchise owners try to buy more FC teams? Wouldn't prioritizing first class make it better too? More exposure, more TV time. To me, it is better for the Kingsmen to buy the Hyderabad. Does he mean football? Does he mean football teams? I'm not actually sure. Football clubs. Because I read that as first class. No, he does mean football team. No, it makes more sense to buy teams in the, so if you buy the CPL teams, we're not talking about a huge amount of money, right? We're talking about a small amount of money. that you are buying these teams with, and then you are, you can train all your coaches up, you can get social media content out of, you can do talent spotting. Like when you're in the Caribbean, you've got 5, 6, 8 experts out there. You can take them out to the nets. You can have a look at people. You can give people trials and everything. It makes a lot more sense to have a CPL team. I do think people will buy football clubs and, you know, other sports eventually as well. I think we've already seen some of that. A lot of the American owners own multiple different sports teams, don't they? So I would assume we will start to see the same with the IPL owners and cricket owners in general. We already have, like, you know, part of the group that owns the Broncos now owns Rajasthan Royals. I think I'm right. You know, so we're already starting to see little bits of that come through. But yeah, if you're actually talking to me at the moment, I think it makes more sense to buy a small league in a cricket. In cricket, Manan says, "Is the MS Dhoni T20 international career video you talk about in that video? You talk about how misunderstood Albie Mawker was as a player. Can you give me some tiny insights before you make a video someday? I grew up as an SA and CSK fan, so he was my favorite player for quite a few years." I think if you go back and you look at what Albie Mawker was absolutely best at, it's batting in the middle overs, right? Crushing spin when you get a chance to be able to do that. And then probably bowling with a brand new ball and swinging it. I tried to pick him for St. Lucia when he was like towards the end of his career because he was just starting to get used a little bit more in that role. And I tried to convince the team, but you know, it wasn't quite the direction that we needed to go in. Or anything else at that stage. But I can't remember who we ended up with. We might have ended up with Warner. So they went in a completely different direction. But yeah, so I think there's that. There's also this misconception that he was like, I think within cricket, people would say he didn't handle pressure very well and he was soft. And I actually think it comes down to the fact he was batting in the wrong overs quite a lot, right? His best use was earlier on in the game. So it wasn't that he was bad at the death for batting or bowling. It's that he wasn't a particularly good death bowler and he wasn't a particularly great death batter. Or he was better in other periods of the game. That's my understanding of him. I haven't done the analysis on him in years, but Varun was saying, I think, some similar things. He's a fascinating player, Albie Mawker. He really is. I'm really glad to see him doing well and getting some coaching gigs and stuff of recent times. James says, how do IPL wide reviews take longer than wicket reviews in the 100? Surely the tracking technology can't be that slow. They're not even using tracking technology though, James. Right? I think that's part of the problem. It's actually just the footage, isn't it? I think everyone should be looking at what the 100 do in all of cricket. But I did talk about this recently, maybe on one of the watch-alongs, of I don't understand why after every delivery is bowled, the umpires aren't looking at starting to start the process of reviewing a ball unless they're 100% sure it's not. Firstly, you have a look at the no ball. The second thing, if the batter's missed it, is it a wide? If it was close to the bat, is there an edge? If it hits the pads, was it going towards the stump? All these sorts of things. Why don't we start it before the reviews? There was a review the other day that I think it had to be at more than 15 seconds anyway, or certainly the TVs made it look like that. And I'm like, well, we're just wasting 15 seconds of our life, 20 seconds of our life that we don't need to. Let's start it straight away. Reese says, what's the best example you can think of this bowler is actually bowling really well, but the batter is just on a different level? Specific spells. Mitchell Johnson to AB de Villiers in Pretoria. Shane Warne to either Sachin Tendulkar or Navjot Sidhu. In various times, really. I'm trying to think of someone else. I don't think Paul Adams bowled poorly to, or Pat Simcox bowled poorly to Brian Lara in the 96 World Cup quarterfinal. Trying to think of some others. I think there was a Rahane 100 once when the ball was doing stuff. It might have been at Lord's, I want to say. I might be misremembering it, but I know that I've seen a Rahane 100 where I was like, actually, this bowling attack's bowling really well to him. It just doesn't matter. I'm saying that partly because I can see a picture of Rahane in front of me. I think the Kumar Sangakkara Hobart 100's another really interesting one going back and having a look at it. I don't think Australia got their plans wrong. I just think that Kumar was on a different level. Cricket boards actually make watching their games almost impossible now. I spend almost as much time trying to find where I can view it as I do actually following the action. That is why I use NordVPN. They let me find all the cricket I want to watch while protecting me from the nasty side of the internet. Nord will free your cricket matches. Grab your exclusive NordVPN deal by going to nordvpn.com/goodareas to get a huge discount off your NordVPN plan plus 4 additional months on top. It's completely risk-free with Nord's 30-day money-back guarantee. Watch every match with NordVPN. Anil says, this IPL particularly seems to be becoming more and more of a power play versus power play shootout. Yeah, definitely. I haven't done the full numbers on it, Anil, but I think you are right. I've got a couple of really interesting shorter videos. Something, kind of a news story has happened today. So straight after I do this, I'm going to have to whip off and write up a story about something. But two of the pieces we were working on was basically how much the game has changed. So one is the wides, as I mentioned earlier. And the other one is that this is the first time ever where the second 10 overs are basically the same pace as the first 10 overs. And I don't think that's ever happened in another league ever before. And it's obviously vastly down to the power play. Although it's also people are still scoring pretty quickly in 7, 8, 9, 10, which they never used to. So it's fascinating watching. The game has really changed quite quickly in the last couple of years. And the impact sub is a part of it, but actually run rates everywhere have changed. You know, like Finn Allen and Tim Seifert, they're not part of the impact sub era, are they? They've been playing in other leagues. Ali says, which format would become better with substitutions the most? ODIs, since it's the middle child? I don't think you can do it with ODIs. I do think you do it with ODIs. Well, I would say Test cricket is the best format, and I think bringing in substitutions would make it more interesting. I love the idea of you having all your best fastball and swing bowlers in the first innings and then bringing out all your spinners in the second innings, and the batters having to be great at both of those things, but also having extra batters available who might be able to switch and choose at that as well. If you really want Test cricket to be the ultimate test, don't you want to be going up against fresh, great bowlers in all different times? Let's say you go in with a spinner in a wicket because you're expecting the wicket to crumble, and it doesn't crumble for spinners for day 4, but it's suddenly up and down. Wouldn't it be great if you could just bring in tall bowlers and the batters had to work on that? And then you had your specialist batters who were good against tall fast bowlers coming in. Like, I just think for me, it doesn't really matter. Any of these three formats would be good, but Test cricket is the best format, and I think it would be fascinating to see it go in that direction. We're a long way away from that. PJ says, what's the ideal batting strike rate to batting average ratio? Or rather, how much does someone with a sub 40 to 50 strike rate have to average to make up for their slow strike rate? So I'm assuming this is Test cricket. I've said this quite a lot. There really isn't a huge amount of difference between someone who has a strike rate of, let's say, 40. It's probably changed a little bit. It used to be 40. Let's go to 45 and 60, right? There really isn't that much of a difference when you look at the impact that they have on a game. Now, you can have a guy who has a strike rate of 45 or 55 who can still be quite attacking, but then can defend in the middle of it, right? So KP might be an example of this, right? Of someone who doesn't have a really high strike rate. Gordon Greenidge is another one. Doesn't have a really high strike rate, but we know they are attacking players. And when they go, right? And so if you take out those kinds of outliers, there isn't that much of a difference between 45 and 60 for the vast majority of players. So I'm not worried about that at all. I'm not worried about strike rates until it's under 40 or it's over 60. Under 40, the issue then is you have to be Pujara or BJ Watling, right? You have to be the world's best defensive batter. And if you're not the world's best defensive batter, you cannot face 12 balls in a row from Vernon Philander, right? You have to get off strike. And so you can't do that if you have no ability to rotate the strike. So, you know, Victorian cricket over the last couple of years has produced these incredible younger players coming through with strike rates of like 27 and 31. And everyone's like, oh, they're going to play for Australia. And I'm like, they're just not. They're not going to be able to rotate strike against the best bowlers in the world. They're just going to get stuck at that end and they're going to be dismissed. You know, I don't know. What's Jeet Ravel's? There's a name from the past. So Jeet Ravel was what? New Zealand's opening batter. 10 years ago now, 15 years ago now. So he had a strike rate of 42, right? I'm more than happy with that. He didn't make any runs. I'm more than happy with that as a defensive batter to be around that area. But if you look at, I'm trying to think of some others that would be below him now. that are more successful than him, right? So Craig Brathwaite, who's had a much longer career, even if his average dropped quite a bit at the end, but he had a good few years in the middle of that, is at 40 again, right? The guys now who average well under, have a strike rate of under 45, generally are struggling to average more than 40. What was BJ Watling? So BJ Watling's is 42. And let's bring up Chiteshwar Pujara. Pujara would be another interesting one for me. Let's have a look. Yeah, so he's at 43 average and 44 strike rate. So those are the new defensive batters. Whereas if you go back to Atherton or someone, in the old days, I think you could get by with like 35 to 37. I just don't think you can anymore. You have to get off strike to the best bowlers in the world pretty consistently now, especially in this era. But once you get over 60, then you become an attacking player and you put pressure back on in the other direction, right? Hertz says, please describe all the different types of square cuts and their cousins. Example, Samson has a whippy one and Azhar has a wristy one. I mean, there's so many variations of what is a very, very similar shot. So a lot of the shots that we see now, that sort of maybe something like the whippy one is probably more of like a slash cut, I would say. The wristy one is probably that sort of one where you cock the bat back and sort of hit the ball a little bit different. You have the sort of more muscular Robin Smith, Travis Head type of cuts. You have people who can cut in front of point, behind point, over point, along the ground. You have obviously the late cut. Like, there's so many variations of that shot. It's actually really hard when you're doing ball descriptions for like Crick Info or as an analyst or whatever, because one person's cut is completely different to someone else's. I remember writing about Dan Christian had that sort of first up and over power cut where he would hit the ball over cover point for six, right? And that shot hadn't really existed consistently before then. And the same version of that would be Santos Jayasuriya, who slashes his, right? They're still basically the same shot, but Santos Jayasuriya is hitting over backward point and using the pace of the bowler. And Dan Christian is more a muscular version, hitting it over the deep sweeper on the offside. There's all these different versions of it. Some people like to hit the ball in front of their body. Some people like to hit the ball behind their body. You'll see that there are players who get back and across a long way. I think the Sri Lankans, when they cut quite often, get really back and across, right? Whereas some people like to stay, they like to cut because they like the distance between them and the ball. So maybe Travis Head would be a good example of that player. So there's just like micro different versions all the way through of that shot. And most shots. A mob says, does the IPL even need foreign player restrictions anymore? No. If the IPL removes the four international player limit, where do you see the IPL and Team India all format quality in 10 years' time? I've got no worries about the Indian quality coming through. You might see a regression in fringe players and specialist players. I just think there's so much talent in India, I wouldn't worry about it. But you might see a slight regression there. You would also see the best players. I mean, if we took away the international player limits, how much better would the IPL be than the top level teams in World Cups, right? And at the moment, they're not, right? Talk to the players and they're like, no, it's still a step up when we get to the top five or six teams, right? The semi-final type stages. It's very clear that there is a step up. That is not the case if you take away the player restrictions. So that means India is going to have a huge advantage over everyone else because their players are going to be playing in a higher level all the time and then coming back. I mean, the argument against this is probably English Premier League football, isn't it? Right? Where that hasn't quite worked. Now, having said that, as good as English Premier League football is, there are still great players in Paris and Germany and Spain. It doesn't quite go in that direction. So maybe in the end, it becomes closer to what the NBA is. But yeah, I think, I just think the talent in India is fine. I also love the idea of one owner going, we're going to go for the India market and we're going to try and see if we can pick an all Indian side. And someone else being like, oh, I really like players from this country. I'm going to get as many as them. I just think it would be interesting tactically, you know, to be able to do that. Josh says, which players are death overs batters who should be power play hitters and vice versa? Adil Rashid. Didn't think I'd say that. Did you, Josh? I always thought with Adil Rashid of like, I don't know how you set a field for Adil Rashid with all the field up, because he squirts the ball in all these different areas and he's a really high level batter, but he's got no power. So once you have five men out, you kind of restrict the impact of him. I think you're looking at guys like Adil Rashid who are probably fairly good bats, who can hit the ball in multiple directions, which means the power play doesn't affect them. In fact, helps them more. As long as they can handle the new ball. You know, I did talk to a lot of the West Indians back in the day about why they were producing so many hitters later on, and they just thought that they weren't producing as many players who were as good against the early moving ball. So that's one thing that you would never truly understand. I think Washington Sundar is probably an example of a player who, because he can hit boundaries in three or four different directions and can play pace and spin, I do wonder if eventually he just becomes a power play hitter. Whereas even though he's done okay at the death, he doesn't average very high, but he's done okay at the death. I don't think he's ever going to have a huge impact at the death. He's just going to be okay. So Washington Sundar is probably a player that I would look at. Trying to think if there's anyone else. So I think why Sunil Narine and David Willey made it work is that they are both worth it. Just they batted in a way where there was no fear, and that they were trying to maximize their strengths. And if it didn't work, it didn't work. So you need someone who believes in that kind of stuff. If you want anyone here, Josh, that I think would be really fascinating, I'm going to throw one more name at you, which is Shardul Thakur. Again, he's not that useful when he comes in T20 games and there's five guys out on the boundary. Bring him in against, he loves playing pace. So get him in the power play, bring all the field up and see how he goes. You're not losing that much from your batting, and you can play him like Sun on her own. Edget says, with so many teams in the IPL taking forever to bowl their overs, we've seen a lot of teams have to bowl the last over with just four players in the outfield. Sometimes both teams in the same match. Yeah, I think the last game might have been that. Are we getting to the point where captains, teams, coaches are just accepting this and not caring and possibly just thinking we can chase down whatever with the extra batter? In that case, wouldn't a 5-run penalty or even a 10 if you want to make it more radical? Yeah, sometimes having the extra fielder in the circle actually helps you keep the runs down as well. You know, we have seen that. It goes quite wildly in both directions. The other way of doing it is, what if, Ajit, we just brought in more players? Right. But yeah, I think at the moment, it doesn't feel like the penalty is working. I agree with you there. Abe says, as a journalist, if you find out about something like a dressing room issue or something about a player off the field, and in neither case would the parties involved prefer that to be public, how do you decide whether to report it or to keep it private? Perhaps you have real life examples where you were caught between honoring your subject's privacy and the public's interest in knowing and the journalistic responsibility. So, sports writers in general don't actually write that much about players' private lives, right? I think let's say it's a dressing room issue and there is a split in the dressing room. So I wrote a big piece years ago about how Andy Flower had lost the team in the 13-14 Ashes. That was very reporting driven. I think if you go back and read that piece, you might not pick it up, Abe. You might just be thinking, oh, from the outside. I remember actually being told by one of the English journalists, oh, you've just come to that opinion watching. And I was like, no, I talked to like eight people, right? That's how I do my stuff. It was very clear to me that there was a break between the players and the coaching staff at that point, and I didn't think it could be mended. And that's not a slight on Andy Flower. These things happen. You know, he ran his course. At that stage, he was quite an intense guy to work for, and I think it caused issues. And I think he's a much better coach now than he was when he coached England, and he got them to number one in the world. But what I didn't really do is talk about the dynamics of that, which are, a lot of which have come out, obviously, with the KP and Cook and Carberry and Tremlett. I can't remember. Trott. I think lots of people have talked about some of that stuff since. But at the time, it wasn't coming out, right? So that was certainly one where I was like, this is actually affecting their cricket, and so it makes sense to write about. I know lots of things about cricketers that would make me a lot of money if I was to sell them to a tabloid, right? Or, you know, just write about them myself. Is it about the cricket? Not really. Can I prove them? Mostly. It's not what I got into this thing to write about. So I think when I was younger, I might have written about some of them, but even then I pretty much held back when I knew things. I might hint at things occasionally or push in that direction, but I think I held back. But if it's about the cricket or I think it's affecting their career, you know, so I wrote a piece, it might have just been at the start of Virat's slump, where I said, and this was again based on reporting, it was really clear to me that Virat was putting as much time into his cricket as he ever had. But it was also clear to me that he was putting way more time into everything else than he ever had before. You know, he had this relationship. He was trying to do some social justice stuff, which is great. He had a million sponsors. He was trying to get into investment. I think he'd started a gym at that. You know, all these different things, right? That he was very hands-on with. And every time I talked to someone, they were like, he's just, you get like 3 minutes of chat to him with him, right? And he's always tired and he's always busy and his cup has runneth over. I wrote a piece about that because I thought that was affecting his cricket. I don't think I write the piece if I don't think it, if he's just handling it and he's just tired. And, you know, I just don't think you do that. Most articles about personal stuff of cricketers, if you think back to the Ben Stokes and his mum piece a while back, you know, there's heaps of versions of this out there, are not written by cricket writers because most people who are doing sports are writing about the sport. Right. So for me, it's quite easy. I don't think I've ever had anything where I've been like genuinely conflicted. I maybe have written about things at times that I shouldn't have pushed as far. Like as in, I'm like, oh, I think this is affecting his cricket. And looking back, I'm like, maybe I'm just making that leap in my head. But generally, if I think it's involving cricket, I think it's fair game to write about. If it's not involving cricket, it's not fair game to write about. And also, I'm not that kind of journalist, as in there are legal ramifications. And when it was at Crick Info, it was much easier because I had the Disney lawyers behind me. When we write things now, we have to be really, really careful because I no longer have that system behind me. But yeah, mostly for me, is it about cricket? If it's about cricket, I'm more than happy to do it. Even if it's like something like, you know, writing about the Saudis and the Ambani relationship, right? For me, that's about cricket. That is going to affect what is going to happen in the future of the game. If the Saudi Ambani partnership had absolutely nothing to do with the future of cricket, I'm probably less likely to be involved in writing about it, I would say. Brian Lara used pot plants to work on his placement. John Wright glued his glove to his bat. Sachin Tendulkar dug up practice pitches. Tatenda Taibu cut the top off his bat. Claire Taylor used a hockey grip. Steve Smith was from tennis. Dean Jones would call phantom runs. And Victor Trumpa turned the Nets into a war zone to survive. The best batters in the world do whatever they have to make runs. We have told their stories in our new book, The Art of Batting. PJ says, 10 years from now, Combox gets sold for $10 billion. Only $10 billion? And after taxes, you walk away with a clean billion. Only a billion? Well, I'm trying to think of what I would actually end up with in that situation. What do you do with the rest of your life? What do you do with the money? Do you fuck around and buy and start a cricket franchise? Will you continue wagon wheels just for shits and giggles? Would you give me $100? No question asked. Probably the last one, PJ. I think I owe you after all these years. So before COVID... Yeah, before COVID, I was working with franchises and basically what I was trying to do is get myself into 2 to 3 franchises. It's like a head of analytics, maybe assistant general manager, maybe even general manager type of person running that franchise, but knowing that I just had, let's say 2 major jobs a year, right? And that I was going to be spending about 4 to 5 months a year making that. I had at the same stage... I had an offer from ESPN.com or ESPN the magazine, whatever they were at that stage, about being their overseas sports writer, writing about non-American stuff for them, like big, you know, 8, 15, 20,000 word features. And then I was kind of like, if I can do those 2 things and I can write a book every 2 years or even a movie script. So at that stage, I was talking to some people in Hollywood about doing some movie stuff. That was kind of my idea then. I think there's still a combination of those things. I don't know if I'll ever go back and work for a franchise directly unless I get the job I want now. So perhaps if I had $1 billion and I could buy a team in a league and play with it the way that I wanted to without it, you know, causing too much financial stress, and I could make money off it. I'm pretty sure I could make money off it from all the stuff that franchise owners don't do at the moment. I might own a team, but I think it's unlikely I would buy a team. I think it's probably more likely that I will write less daily, like less about cricket, but I'm a writer, so I'm going to be writing every day anyway. There was a fascinating Twitter post recently about someone saying that with podcasts and videos taking over, it's ruining writers. And someone like tweeted my name at the top. I'm like, motherfucker, I've just written two books. I've got two more almost under contract, or one under contract. One will be under contract very shortly. And I'm writing on Substack like 2 and 3 times a week. I write. So I will never stop writing. I don't know if I would continue Wagon Wheel specifically. I would definitely keep podcasting. But I don't know what that would be in the future. And how that would go. I'd love to keep doing the video essays, but again, along with the writing, I don't just want it to be about cricket. You know, I want there to be other subjects as well involved in that. I have to finish a novel because I think it's going to annoy me. And I'd like to do some more writing for either TV or movies. But yeah, I'm a writer. I'll give you a story, actually. Mark Nicholas and Gideon Haigh were talking about writing. And Gideon Haigh told Mark Nicholas that he writes every day. And Mark Nicholas was like, what? Every day? And Gideon's like, yeah, every day. That's how I do it. And then Mark was telling me that story, expecting me to be shocked at that. And Mark looked at me and went, you write every day too? And I went, yeah. He's like, what about on holiday? I said, my wife knows that, especially when we had kids, that I almost write better on holiday than I do anywhere else. That sort of bit where everyone's in bed and it's late and, you know, we've had a big meal and we've been out doing stuff all day. That's almost my best. I can get incredible stuff done on holidays. Wrote a whole documentary for the Channel 9 one that never got shown while I was on holiday, right? Just an hour and a half, but I can, you know, so I write every day. So it doesn't really matter to me how rich I am. I will be writing or making something every single day. That's what I wanted to do. Being rich is really helpful for my family and everything. And I would love to have mortgages paid off and, you know, loans paid off and, you know, own things and, you know, be able to travel around a little bit more easily and everything else. That, like, you know, since COVID's come, it's been really tough for me financially. And it wasn't before, right? I was doing quite well before and it's not been the same. But with or without COVID, like, I'm still going to want to make things. I just like to write things and make things. And maybe it gives me a bit more freedom. I had that little period when I almost got the ESPN gig where I was hoping to be able to move out of cricket, not so I wouldn't write about cricket anymore, but just so I could write about cricket when I wanted to, rather than doing it all the time. And that didn't work. I'd still love to get back to that, I think. I mean, I'm never going to stop coming up with ideas for cricket. So I'm never going to stop writing about cricket or making stuff about cricket. Hertz says, top three ICC tournaments in your life by impact, drama, chaos, and why? Excuse my short form, practicing writing 50 character super chats. 92 World Cup is probably the most important one ever. 1973 Women's Tournament is probably the second most important ever. 2017 20 World Cups, probably up there as well. Those are the three, right, for importance. But if you're talking about impact, drama, and chaos, I think 92 just changes everything. So I'll go with 92. There's something about 2019 that I really like. I think I would have 2019 really high, especially the way it finished and the 2-day game, you know, and Pakistan coming home after being, you know, all these different things were happening. So I feel like that one is really high up on my list. You know, there's an absolute cracker of a women's one in New Zealand, and I can't remember the year off the top of my head as well, where every game seemed to be just ridiculously good in a way that I don't know if we've ever seen another World Cup do that. Josh says, why does the live stream titles use CHE instead of CSK? So we have to set ourselves up as a long-term business, Josh. And the actual names of the franchises and the logos of the franchises and everything are all copyrighted, so you can't use them. And it's one of these things that the BCCI did, which I think is probably a bit of an error. And I think you can pay for them. I don't really see the point of it, but like, it's not giving them that much money. But I do know that other companies have been in trouble and caught out with it at various times. We're just trying to stay on the right side of the BCCI at this stage. And yeah, then we're not, Cricket Evolve done it before. I don't know if CricBuzz ever did. They might have bought the rights all the time, but many other places have done it as well. You know, hopefully from next year we could talk to the BCCI and, you know, form partnerships with people and everything else. I don't even know if it's that expensive, but we don't have it. You know, we're in the middle of our family and friends round. We're almost finished that round. You know, us spending money on something like this at the moment, just, you know, barely getting ourselves online for the lives at the moment. Ajit says, how and why have IPL grounds not understood home advantage? A lot has been talked about playing conditions not matching a squad's playing style. But even outside of that, why are they doing stuff like playing other teams' songs when they get boundaries and wickets? I'd be very upset by a fan or a player with my stadium there. No, I think some grounds do it and some don't. It's fascinating to me. We had this discussion maybe last year or the year before about how Dhoni... like teams would still suck up to Dhoni and Kohli on their social media feeds because they're almost bigger than the brand still, right? I think that's just early on and those things will move on. I'd be shocked if in the future they don't do it. The pitches, I'll give you a really interesting thing on the pitches. The IPL owners don't always completely control the pitches, right? One of the most fascinating things in the world for me is that the IPL is this like billion-dollar entity and like, you know, maybe it'll get to the level of the NFL and, you know, maybe it'll make as much money as some of these other leagues in the next 5 or 6 years and all these sorts of things. And you've still occasionally got grumpy, tenured grounds staff who just do what they want. It's hilarious, really. I think a lot of that will change when the teams own the stadiums, which may not happen for all teams, but we're assuming that's going to happen in the future. You know, everyone kind of assumes that RCB is going to be the first one to do that. And we'll see that sort of thing coming along in the future. And I think the longer this goes and the less it becomes about India and the more it becomes about your home team, I think the other stuff that you're talking about will just change naturally, is my guess. Abe says, what's a skill young cricketers are still taught that isn't very useful anymore? And what's one that they don't learn enough that would be more valuable now? I think the one that always bugs me is the forward press, right? That really, really getting on your head over the top of the ball against a pace bowler is impossible and it's not at any way. I don't even think it's helpful in club cricket. It's certainly not helpful at the level above club cricket. It's not how people play pace anymore. Even in club cricket, quick bowling is so much faster than it used to be. It's a no from me. I think it's an incorrect way of playing fast bowling. Even on English wickets and New Zealand wickets where it seems around, even on Asian wickets where it keeps low, I just don't see how thrusting yourself forward to smother a ball is your best option rather than watching it and hitting it under your eyes more naturally. What are things that they don't learn enough that would be more valuable now? I mean, it's crazy to me that we don't teach people to throw with both arms. I think that's got to be something that into the future we, you know, Alan Border and Ian Harvey have already proven that works. We need more people like them. Did Sachin throw both arms too? It might not have been Sachin. I think there was another player as well. I think throwing with both arms is really, really important. I still don't think we teach running between the wickets correctly. So yeah, there's bunches of them. Also, I think that now we're only just getting to the point now where we understand that, like, if you really want to be good at scooping, you really have to start those sorts of things earlier on. Whereas I think what we were doing beforehand was... What we were doing beforehand was more, I could tell that sneeze was coming. It was like, get all the fundamentals right. And I'm like, yeah, but at a certain point, scooping, reverse sweeps, coming down the wicket, whatever it may be, are now fundamentals, right? And the more options you have, the harder it is for you to set a field for, right? And so it makes sense. So I think those are the sorts of things, Abe, that I would be looking at. Yeah, very much. All right, let us have a quick break here on the wagon wheel. And then when we come back, we'll see if there's anything in the chat as well. I once made a pair in a club game, which is almost impossible to do. But I've been obsessed with batting my entire life. And so I put that into my new book, The Art of Batting. Being that I'm not very good at that skill, I decided to talk to other people who were. So I hit up as many contacts as I could just to talk about Rahul Dravid, Brian Lara, AB de Villiers, Kumar Sangakkara, Ross Taylor, Susie Bates, Nasser Hussain, Ian Chappell, and so many, many, many more. I wanted batters to talk about how they and their friends made runs, because that is the art of batting. All right, Jessica, the Transmental Alchemist, coming in again, an absolute legend. She always is. I've got a super sticker as well. Siddharth gives me that one, so thank you very much. There aren't that many super chats, so I'll just take a couple of chats since they're in here and then finish up, because I've got a couple of minutes. I mean, I don't have any time. Amu says, with watch-alongs, your YouTube channel is gaining more popularity. What do you think of the haters in live streams? Not just against you, but in general. I don't always see them. I find it very hard when we're doing stuff. I find it very, very hard when to read the comments when we're doing these channels, because there's just so many people in them. I know that there are people that it affects more. You got to remember, I started as a blogger. One of the first messages I ever had on the old Cricket with Balls blog was, you know, that I was a typical left-wing hipster doofus from Melbourne in the suburbs who didn't know anything about anything. Like, that was probably like the third or fourth comment I ever got on the blog, right? It's been there since the start. I think it affects you a lot more when you're starting your career and you're not 100% sure who you are. I think over this period of time, it's actually probably set me up for an online career more than anything else. I think I've said this many times before, but I was there when all the English newspaper journalists went on Twitter and had no idea all these people hated them, right? Because how many letters to an editor do you ever receive? Right? Some of my very famous friends who are major broadcasters have also shown at times they've really, really struggled to handle it. And I handle it in a much easier way because it was there from the first moment I started, right? Almost every single thing I have done, one of the first comments was just incredibly anti-me and hateful. As I said, the Cricket with Balls was one. I can't remember what the one on the podcast was, but there was something about me being an idiot on the podcast. And the first videos that we really started doing, when me and Sam Collins, back when it was Two Pricks at the Ashes before it became the Two Chucks, Martin Williamson, who was working at Crick Info, literally like slagged me off in a comment. So it was like even someone in the industry. And so, but by the time Martin Williamson did that, like, I just put back a little joke message going back, actually, you guys are paying me to be here because I'm working for you. So, you know, thanks for the reaching out. And I was used to doing that sort of stuff. So it's much easier for me to be able to handle it and just move on. I'm also very much from the Maya Angelou side of things of like, if I'm doing the work correctly and I'm going all the way through, I don't have to listen to the people telling me I'm great and I don't. Yeah, sorry, I should say, I don't have to listen to people telling me I'm terrible, because I also don't listen to people who are telling me I'm great, right? Like, for me, I can tell if the work isn't the level I want it to be. I know what I am capable of. I know when it's rushed. I know when it's wrong. You know, I can feel all those sorts of things. That isn't the case for everyone, right? And so at this stage, 20 years in, there's a battle-hardened skill. And a lot of the people who are abusing you quite often don't understand what you're talking about, because, you know, they come to it, you know, Good Areas or Combox, and we're talking about cricket from quite a high perspective, and we've got all this data in front of us and all this information and incredible historical facts and all this sort of stuff. And you've got some 16-year-old kid who just really likes a player and doesn't understand why we're saying something negative about them. So how am I going to get that upset? I remember being attacked by a Pakistani journalist a few years ago on Twitter who kept calling me racist. And ultimately, what it came down to is a lot of here, and I don't like him at all, he's a horrible person, but I understand where this came from, because I think a lot of what's coming from him is, in his mind, what he was basically saying is, this: the Pakistani cricket team is my identity, and this other guy just likes them because they play cricket and is saying all these things about them and doesn't really care about them that much, which in some ways is true, right? So I can't sit there and have an argument with that guy, because we're coming at this from two different areas. And quite often you get that on the messages as well, like on the live chats on YouTube. What am I supposed to do? If someone comes at me with what I think is a smart critique or is trying to add to the conversation, I'll try and bring it in. If someone's just being a dick, then they're just being a dick, right? There's not much you can do about that. Just on the Usman Tariq says, attention for Kanada says, the time he spends it at each stop isn't consistent. It varies with each delivery, and that's the issue. So, but the difference here is, and this is what is really important, is that he is actually stopping for each delivery, whereas the guys who were doing it before were not. Right. And I think that's why Usman Tariq has sort of fallen through the cracks a little bit. You're right. It's not going to be consistent. I mean, your run-up isn't consistent either. And that's what I mean. The actual wording needs to change a little bit. There's no way he's going to stop for, you know, what would it be? Let's say seven hundredths of a second every single time. Right. So we have to understand, is it sometimes he does it for 500ths of a second and sometimes he does it for a second. Are we okay with that? Right. Or is sometimes he's doing it for a second and a half, and sometimes he's doing it for like a 300th. And we're like, well, we're not okay with that. We have to understand that. That's the way that you need to go ahead. What else do we have here? Just quickly. Another one from Amy who says, how does the number three batter in Test cricket in tough conditions against good bowlers rotate strike without risking the chance of edging or getting LBW? Feels very difficult. Who's the best at it? Yeah, I mean, no one, really. I mean, Kane Williamson? It doesn't really matter if you're a number three or an opener or a number four in those conditions. Once you're in the tricky conditions, it's about knowing how you get off strike. So Steve Smith knows how to get off strike, whether he's at three or four. And he's going to move outside the line and try and turn a ball from just outside off stump to backward square leg or in front of square leg, depending on where the field is. Kane Williamson is going to get the ball in the channel and he's going to use very, very loose, soft hands and he's going to guide the ball just to the left of gully, right? Joe Root is going to do a very similar shot, but play the ball right under his eyes, and he's going to guide the ball either to cover point or to backward point and hope he's always on the other side of the fielder. That's what the very best players do, and they find that method, and that allows them to get off strike when they need to get off strike. Every player has a slightly different one, you know, that they're looking for. You know, if you go back to Steve Waugh, it was like dropping the ball in the gap. Right? His big thing was, if I use soft hands and drop it in the gap, I'm quick enough and my partner should be quick enough to always get a single in this area. Whereas you might see someone like Sachin, who is more likely to, again, try and find that gap at square leg or mid wicket and look for that, or look for the gap at cover, right? Dropping the ball, pushing the ball towards cover and taking off. Everyone's a little bit different with that. Siddharth says, hey, Jared, no questions. I just want to say well done and congratulations to you and everyone at Combox and Good Areas. Loving the content. Keep up the good work. I will be back later. Thank you very much, Siddharth. Look, it's been a big thing. We're trying to do this all unfunded. And so, you know, doing a live watch along is an intense thing for over a long period of time. We've got, you know, different internet connections, different cameras. We've got producers on the back end. We're not all watching it at the same time. Not everyone, you know, a lot of the people that are doing these watch alongs for us at the moment have not done a lot of watch alongs before. It's easy for me and Rob Barron. It's not as easy for some of the other people. So thanks to everyone who's helped supporting us on that. Walnut says, any expectations, predictions on the West Indies 4-day championship? I think you've asked me this before and I answered it. It's unfortunately, you know, not something I have looked into. It's just not something that I've looked into all that much. I could tell you there are times of the year, and if you're a West Indies fan, Walnut, you probably know more than me, but there are times in the year when I do pay a lot of attention to some of the List A cricket played in the West Indies, and it's because the games come on quite late at night and I can watch them and, you know, and relax a little bit, learn about younger West Indies players. But I've never done that with the 4-day tournament. So I don't really have any, I'm just having a look at some of the teams here. So what was that? Guyana versus Windward Islands. Who's batting at the moment? So Guyana's batting. So I know Chandrapaul, I know Kemo Paul. Yeah, so I know a few of the players in that side. And who have Windward got? Obviously, I know Kevin Hodge. And so I know enough, but I don't think I would have like any enough to give you an idea on who should win. Oh, Sunil Ambrose made 100 or anything like that. It's just, you know, even if you were to ask me who's most likely to win the county championship, like, I mean, Surrey, I suppose, without doing any research, just because they might. But I wouldn't, there's no way I'd be able to tell you that. Shield a little bit more, but only because I follow Victoria as a fan, right? So I generally know who's doing well in Shield cricket in relationship to Victoria. But yeah, I mean, my dream cricket job was always writing about first class cricket, and it died almost at the start of my career. Suha says, why are most of the goat bowlers a pacers? Traditionally in cricket, you would have three pace bowlers for every spinner to start with. So if you were looking at the top 10 bowlers of all time, you would have what? Warren and Murali and eight pace bowlers. Not that far off that mathematics to start with. Secondly, spin bowlers are generally underrated because they have higher bowling averages, but they have higher bowling averages, but they also can bowl a lot more overs. So they come back in another way. Thirdly, I think the idea has been, you know, cricket is still an English sport, maybe less so now than ever before, but an English sport. And that if you look at cricket, even when you're playing in Asia, the normal bowling lineup's probably more likely to be two pace and two spin. And when you're playing outside of Asia, it's likely to be three pace and one spin, right? So pace bowlers are important even in the places they are not important. So I do think all of these things make a bigger change than anything else. Like, I do think there is a reason for that. And I'll take two more, I think. Unknown Sports Fan says, can you explain why 1992 changes things? 1992. So 1987 is a really important World Cup because it's the first one outside of the UK. But it's not broadcast particularly well. It's not easy for fans around the world to see it. 1992 is coloured clothing, white balls. We've never had any of those things in a World Cup before. It is a spectacle in a way that the previous World Cups were not. It felt like all the teams were together, even if it was just for a couple of photo shoots, right? It felt like there was actually a big event happening and not just individual things that would eventually end up in finals. It was marketed really, really well. It was filmed at a much higher level than cricket had ever been filmed outside of, you know, other Australian stuff. That's why it was filmed so good. But a lot of cricket around the world was still filmed absolutely terribly. And it kind of birthed the 1990s ODI start, you know, takeover of cricket, which ended up in the T20 takeover of cricket, right? It was a spectacle that you could make money off. And by 96, we had worked that out. 99, 2003, like everything just keeps adding on. So a really, really fascinating one from that perspective. Walnut says, would bowling cutters be a good way to test for turn on a surface so you don't have to risk bringing a spinner on prematurely? It's a really good question. It's very rare, Walnut, for a bowler to put enough revolutions on the ball to spin it. Someone did it the other day. One of the young bowlers, is it Saki Pasan? I think we saw him get it, and then I think someone else might have done it as well. So you can do it, but it's very rare. Generally, what happens is you're bowling so fast, the ball still goes through, right? It holds in the surface, but it doesn't turn. So you could do that. Once the ball holds in the surface, it should theoretically spin. So that'll give you a bit of an idea. Just, you know, I mean, I think you might as well. I don't think you... You're not just bringing a spinner on, though, because it's spinning, are you? I would think. I think you're also bringing a spinner on to give the batter something else to have a look at. You want to ask them different questions. You might also be in a situation where the ball isn't spinning, but it's doing something else for the spinners that is handy. It might be drifting more than normal. It might be skidding on in a weird way. It might be keeping low. So I don't think you would just do it from the perspective of, I want to see if the ball is spinning or not spinning. I think it's a lot more convoluted than that. Just the last one, I just saw it come through by Suha. It says, do you think the difference in average height of populations and ethnicity has an impact on the amount of quality seam bowlers they produce? I would think that the pitchers play a much, 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 much bigger part. So English bowlers... I would be shocked if English people are that much shorter than Australians, right? Like on average. Like, I have no idea, but I'd be shocked because Australia has a, you know, is a former England colony with lots of white English people in it, right? So why have Australian bowlers been taller than English bowlers? Because it makes a lot more sense to be tall when you're bowling in Australia because the extra bounce is really important. In England, lateral movement is more important. So you're much more likely to have a skill-based bowler in England who can move the ball laterally than you are to have a tall bowler from that perspective. So yeah, at a certain point, I would say if you go back traditionally, the height of bowlers wasn't that important. I think when the front foot no ball comes in, it probably helps. And West Indies, Australia, maybe South Africa, because of the pitches, have more tall bowlers and probably, I don't know, they might be taller than some of these other countries as well. But like if you look at a place like India or Pakistan, I would say that there are still enough tall people that that shouldn't be the reason. But being a tall bowler in Pakistan is probably nowhere near as helpful as it is in other places, right? Being a tall bowler in Australia, you get two bites of the cherry. You get the weird release point, which is hard for a lot of batters, and then you get the extra bounce off the surface. So I would say that that has a big one. Just the last one, because I just saw it come through. Disco Desmond says, it's surprising to hear you're not too fussed about working at franchise cricket. I would have thought with the analysis you're consistently able to provide that it'd be something you want to do year round. I think the issue would be Disco Desmond. I would only want to do it if it would be on my terms. And I can't imagine any owner is going to come and allow that. So I wouldn't go back and be an analyst anymore because I enjoyed it, but I think long-term it would cause me a lot of issues. I also would want to run the large parts of the franchise. And I think a lot of owners would be like, no, we've got other people to do that. And I'd be like, yeah, I think I know more about cricket marketing and social media content and everything else to be able to do that. And I don't think I'd be allowed to do that. So my last major potential job was with Rajasthan Royals. And I can tell you exactly what happened. I thought I was coming in from an analyst point of view because I assumed that's what the job was. They decided that they actually wanted me to come in and run their content after talking to me about analyst stuff, right? So fine. They were like, you're good at this and you're good at this. We want this part. Then they basically said that the rest of the people who ran Rajasthan were a little bit worried that I would be too rogue and would, you know, cause issues for them with their content. And so they didn't think they could control me. If you can't control me for content, how are you going to control me around your players when I'm an analyst or a general manager or anything else? And I think that there is a feeling out there that that is the case. So I would need to be in a situation where I had an entire team and I knew, you know, I had a long-term contract. I felt very confident with that contract. I'm still unpaid by lots of teams I've never played for anyone before. I'd need to be really, really confident to be able to do it. I'd have to have a great relationship with the owner. I'd have to be involved in who the coaching staff are and what the overall thing is. And I'd need some sort of stake in the team. Not financial stake, as in I don't want points on the team, but I want to know that if I build something here, I have the ability to use it for a long period of time and I won't just be flicked away for someone who's cheaper in the future. I just don't see that happening. Now, a lot of the people who are buying IPL franchises now have grown up consuming my content to the point at which when I meet some of them and, you know, potential owners, they're contacting me because they want to chat about something, right? So perhaps that relationship changes things a little bit. But as it currently stands, I just don't know that I'd ever be able to do the job the way I want to do it. And until I can do it the way that I want to do it, there are so many other things I want to do in the world that I loved working with cricket teams. Being the general manager of St. Lucia is probably my favorite thing I ever did. But I also lost about 10 kilos through stress at times during that job. I think I lost 8 kilos, which I do think came from stress. I didn't get paid to be the general manager of that franchise. There were issues. I was told to do something by the owner. I did it, and which caused a rift between me and a player, which didn't need to happen. If I'm going to do it, I want to do it my way and do it correctly. I just don't see that as something coming in the future. Could be wrong. Also, as Sidhav says, I just want a medium rest. I'd like to do things. Look, if you look at my whole career, right? I like to do things my way. I could be wrong. I'm more than happy to say that, but I like to do things my way. And I would like to think that so far in my career that I have earned that right. And I don't see that opportunity in franchise cricket right now. That may not be the case in 6 months' time or 2 years' time or 5 years' time. You know, it wasn't that long ago another franchise was talking to me about a potential position, you know, asking me if I would be interested again. I'm always interested, but I want to do it properly. And what I found in cricket is no one wants to do it properly. Everyone does it half-assed. And if you look at my entire career, you can say a lot of things about me. Half-assed is probably not one of them. I Am No One's is finishing the show by saying, is phasing out Shami, Ishan and Bhuvi as India has done a good plan in the long term from the perspective of, does this allow India to find newer pace prospects and give them a chance, or does it discourage pace bowlers? I think with Ishan and Bhuvi, Ishan had just, I think he was maybe phased out 6 months early. I think they should have given him a little bit more time. But old fast bowlers, that's generally what happens to them. I think with Bhuvi, they just thought they had better options, more strike bowling options. Again, I have no issues on that kind of thing. I'd definitely be more interested in moving Bhuvi aside. Does that allow for Siraj and Ashdeep to come through, who are probably, all things considered for India, better bowlers over more formats overall? And I love Bhuvi as a player, but I think those other guys might have slightly higher ceilings. Shami is the only one I would say that there's a real question mark over. I think their issue, though, is just he can't bat, although bat number eight. And they already have other guys in that side who can't bat. But I think they can still move back to Shami without any issue. And if he keeps bowling the way he is this year, I have no problems with that. I think that's okay. But he's just not fit. Right. And until they know he's fit at his age, and he's never been fit really at any stage in his career, I think there's always going to be a question mark over Mohammad Shami. And I love him as a bowler. So it's a real shame, but that's kind of how these things go, right? Anyway, I thank you very much to everyone for the comments, the super chats, all your support on Patreon. We'll be back in about 20 minutes or so for the watch along. So if you're here now, spend 20 minutes doing something and then come back. I don't know, read a book, touch some grass, send a message to an old lover. But I'll be back again very soon for that. But big thanks to everyone who helped on Wagon Wheel today. And this show only works because you guys ask really good questions. And you guys ask really good questions. Thank you for listening to this podcast on the Combox Network. There is an ad-free version of this you can find by supporting us on Patreon at Good Areas Podcast. You can also access our Discord channel there. Please like, subscribe, and rate this show. Every one of these helps us. If there was a guest on a show, you can find their links in the show notes. Huge thanks to Rakshit, Ishit, and everyone else who helps us get our content out there. If you want to know more about us, head to combox.tv. If you make a lot of content like me, oh, you are going to need help. And that is why we use Minvo.pro, a slicing and dicing tool that uses AI to conjure up incredible clips from your podcasts and meetings. If you make content, go to Minvo.pro to cut it.